Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of January. A new book based on quite a bit of study by both of our guests this hour, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, shows that large numbers of students don't appear to be learning very much in the first 2 years of college. What's going on? We'll talk about that the first hour of our program today, and we have two guests with us. Richard Arum is professor of sociology and education at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. He is teaching methodology, stratification, and sociology of education, and he has written extensively on improving learning environments in schools, lessons from abroad, comparative study of self-employment dynamics and social inequality, and the list goes on. We welcome the professor to our program. He's one of the authors of the book, the aforementioned book. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Arum.
Kathleen, I'm just so grateful that you are making time to invite a thoughtful discussion of this important topic.
Yes, we are happy to do so, very happy to do so. Also joining us, the other author of the report, Josepha Roxa, and Professor Roxa is Assistant Professor of Sociology with a courtesy appointment in the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. Professor Roxa's primary research interests are in social stratification and education, and her research to understand the transmission of advantage across generations, inequality in access, attainment, and learning in higher education. She teaches courses at the undergraduate and graduate levels at the University of Virginia. Professor Roxa, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you for having us this morning.
So I'm giving a general statement here, but the thrust of the entire report is something's greatly amiss in the first 2 years of college. Students simply aren't learning very much. Why?
Yes, well, and also, unfortunately, the news is not just, it's worse than just the 2 years. Yesterday, we issued a report simultaneous with the book release that showed for the full 4 years of student experiences in college. Now that we have that full 4 years of data, the picture really did not significantly improve from our earlier account in the book. Now, over the full 4 years of college, 36% of students showed no significant improvement on a measure of higher order learning skills, critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing. Now, the question of why that's the case, you know, our data, we also surveyed these kids and collected their transcripts, and we find that for all too many students in colleges today, too little is being asked of them.
Mm.
We found when in a typical semester, we asked students, how many courses are you taking where you are being asked to write 20 pages over the course of the semester, 20 pages. 50% of the students said they did not have a single course.
Oh my goodness.
That asked them to write 20 pages. We asked them, how many courses are you taking where you are being asked to read 40 pages per week on average, 40 pages per week. And 32% of the kids said they did not have a single class that asked them to write, to read 40 pages per week on average. 36% of the kids in our study say they are studying five or fewer hours per week, studying alone to prepare for their class. Given how little is being asked of them, and how little they're being asked to apply themselves to their studies, it's really no surprise or wonder that they're not moving at all on this indicator measuring their general skills.
Professor Roxa, is that a change from years past, so little being asked now? Did it used to be more?
It seems to certainly be the case, at least in terms of how much students seem to be studying. So the economists Babcock and Marx, you may be familiar, have done a study trying to track time use over really the course of the 20th century and find that students used to study about twice as much as they do today. In about in 1960s and 70s, the number of hours students are spending studying has decreased dramatically to today, which is what we have, about 12 to 14 hours a week.
Mm. So why the shift? What happened?
Well, you know, we argue that in the book that it it's too easy to just point fingers at, you know, at one actor or another, that, you know, students are to blame for this, or faculty. What we argue instead in the book is that there is an organizational culture currently in today's colleges and universities that places undergraduate learning as near the bottom of the priorities that the institution is attempting to accomplish.
Hmm.
Colleges and universities are asked to do many, many things for our society, and they do many of them well. They're asked to generate new knowledge and scientific advances for industry and for society. They are asked to accept more and more students and to retain them and keep them in, and to attend to their social needs and general broad needs while in college, to keep them safe. They are asked to raise money to build endowments. They are asked to produce primetime television, college bowls, and entertainment. They've been asked to do many things. Unfortunately, the core mission of colleges and universities to teach undergraduate education is often relatively undervalued and inadequately prioritized, given these great set of demands that they are facing today.
And is this true across the board? Did you look at elite universities, state schools, private schools? Is it true everywhere?
Yeah, you know, we have a sample that has a fairly small number of schools, so we can actually isolate specific institutions and then say how much they're learning. But we should note, and we note in, you know, the book, that 23% of the variation is across institutions. So institutions do make a difference. But that also says that the other part, the largest part of variation, is within institutions. And so that means that there are students who are doing particularly well at every school, and unfortunately, there are students who are not doing well, and that's true across the board. And so while, you know, there are some schools that do better than others, and we do find that, and we do find learning at certain institutions more than others, overall, we'd like to point out that it is, in the variation is really within institutions, and that a lot can be done across the board in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let me jump in just add a little bit there. You know, selective colleges in particular, the more selective they are in terms of the students they take in, those colleges and universities tend to have slightly higher academic demands placed on students, greater academic rigor in terms of reading and writing requirements. The students apply themselves a little bit more in terms of their studying, and you know, we see that the kids, on average, learn slightly more in these places, even controlling for all their other background. And so, you know, while we do find these differences, as my co-author has mentioned, the bigger story is that at all these institutions, no matter how selective they are, there are pockets of students where little learning is occurring. And we need to develop organizational cultures where colleges and universities look for those pockets and figure out strategies and ways to ensure that learning happens there.
Right. So if there isn't in that pocket a lot of writing going on and very little reading going on, what in the world are the students doing?
Well, it's possible that they are doing subject, working on subject-specific skills. As you know, there's been a huge growth in recent decades in professional programs, the applied programs, such as business, communication, health, and so on. It's possible that they're working on subjects, specific skills, which the CLA does not measure. However, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, right, we've got 36% of the kids saying they are studying 5 or fewer hours per week. And so it's hard for me to imagine that no matter what you're measuring in terms of an objective measure, even if it's a subject specific, that with that level, those levels of effort, you're really going to see much movement on any indicator.
Mm-hmm. So you suspect there are a lot of video games going on, perhaps a few parties?
Well, you know, the kids today are indeed working to support themselves slightly more than in the past. We saw, again, the time use data that my co-author referenced before, going back historically, kids work about 5 more hours. Full-time college students work about 5 more hours for pay today to support themselves and to support their lifestyles. It's not just that they're working for pay, though. It's something else is going on where they're spending large amounts of time, doing everything else that they're asking to be colleges are about, socializing, networking, and it's not that there's no place for that in college, but unfortunately, I think the balance has become a little off for large numbers of students, and colleges and universities haven't done a very good job of tracking what's going on their campuses to make sure that all students are being exposed to a rigorous academic program.
Right. Professor Roxa, is there a great deal of focus on many college campuses among faculty to put their emphasis on research?
Well, research seems to suggest that. We don't actually study that. Our sample is students, and we ask them how much they are doing. But research certainly suggests that the priorities on college campuses have focused on research, and you would expect that perhaps at research-intensive institutions. But recent work suggests that has spread across the higher education across the board. And so the extent to which faculty hiring, faculty promotion depends much more on research, and research is deemed to be more important than
yeah, I would,
is
let me just say, you know, just to add here, let me cut to the chase. Listen, the incentives in most of these colleges and universities today are all misaligned so that faculty are rewarded for research productivity, and the incentives for in terms of promotion, tenure, raises, it's all focused in most of these institutions towards faculty research and not towards teaching. Now, let me say, though, it's an important caveat. In other schools, in some of the lower-tier public universities and colleges in this country that educate large numbers of students, there have been dramatic cuts in full-time faculty, where instruction today is often being provided by low-paid adjuncts that are struggling to support themselves. And so, you know, in those cases, it's not distraction with faculty research that's the problem. You know, it's a problem that, you know, the lack of full-time faculty, you know, to begin with.
Right. We welcome phone calls for our guests, and there's much more to look at as we analyze their research and their book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, which was released yesterday, and you may have read about it. It made a lot of press in various newspapers yesterday. Our guests are Professor Richard Arum, Professor of Sociology and Education at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. Professor Josipa Roxa is Assistant Professor of Sociology in the universe and also teaches in the School of Education at the University of Virginia, and they are co-authors of this report. Our phone number, one line is open. Let me give you the number and the email address. Phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program today, Peter Bergen will be joining us. He is the national security analyst, terrorism expert for CNN. He's the author of a number of books, and we'll talk about his latest, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. We go to phone calls now for our guests. We start with Gene in Oshkosh. Hi, Gene.
Good morning, Kathleen and guests. I am blessed in being in my 17th year of retirement from academe. And I toiled at about six different universities, good universities, and as both an administrator and faculty. The reason, and when I say I've been retired 17 years, I'm trying to make a point here. Really, the reason I retired, actually a year early, I had an option, and that is it was not unusual. In fact, this is research in the making. It's not unusual to see a correlation between the average grades given by faculty in the university and tie them into the use of student evaluations of teaching. In other words, if I give good grades, my students realize that I'm giving them a gift, and I will give the professor a good evaluation. That, I think, is very, very detrimental. Your point about the adjuncts scare the daylights out of me because I brought a college, a full college of business, evaluation. What I'm saying is we got the thing accredited by stressing one thing, and that was quality, and we used full-time faculty. But there's one other issue that I'd like you to is it in your current academic research, or is it something you could add? And that is the tremendous rapid rise of for-profit education. And it seems to me that that is a variable that is just pulling down the quality of the product we're selling and the ability to use a good product that we may be selling. I'd appreciate comments along those lines.
All right. Thank you, Gene, so much for the call. Professor Roxa, would you like to start?
I sure can. We appreciate your call and the comment about evaluations and grades. Indeed, there is research out there suggesting that, and may not be surprising that good grades are associated with good evaluations. And that, you know, creates another perverse incentive in higher education. If for tenure, as my co-author mentioned, the primary requirement is research. But if teaching comes into the calculation, it usually comes through student evaluations. And so if student evaluations are good, when we give students good grades, unfortunately, that does create another incentive to create easy classes with little reading, little writing, and give students good grades.
Mm-hmm. Can I jump in on the for-profit question?
Yes, sure. Please.
You know, in terms of for-profits, I actually think that, you know, the situation is somewhat complicated. You know, while certainly no fan of the for-profit sector and you know I think we have, like many of my colleagues, we have reasons to be skeptical and worry about that sector. You know, at the same time, it is those institutions that are taking, that often take the most seriously the measurement of student learning that occurs in their classes. In fact, because their legitimacy is questioned and challenged by the outside world, they are often very interested and adamant about setting up plans to measure and assess learning. And, you know, it's often the not-for-profits and the public universities that are, you know, are just now trying to think about putting in place systems of evaluating student learning on their campuses.
Yeah, and, you know, if I can jump in, I think sometimes we really get worried about for-profit sector, but I think we have to keep in mind the size. They are growing very fast, so growth is fast, but proportionally, they are still a very small proportion of higher education. And what we have observed in this book is not, you know, the for-profit sector. So sometimes I think we have to understand that higher education as a whole has something to think about and worry about, other than kind of focusing on this one part of the system.
Yeah, and if the public universities aren't expanding and the nonprofits aren't expanding fast enough to meet the increased demands out there, you know, let's be thankful and grateful that other institutions like the for-profits are stepping in to expand access. So you know, it's a more complicated, you know, story about the for-profits. I think than one might initially conclude. Although again, you know, as soon as the profit, you know, there's profit incentives driving the organizational behavior. We all do well to be very careful about thinking about these organizations and making sure that they're operating effectively, honestly, with integrity, and so on.
Here's an email that's come in from Gary in Iron River. How do these facts vary by course of study? I know that many colleges and universities are producing functional bachelor's degree engineers in 4 to 5 years. There is no way these statistics can apply to these folks. Engineering students need to study closer to 5 hours per day than per week. Professor Roxette, you want to start?
Yeah, well, I guess I can. You know, we do indeed find variation by field of study, both in terms of how much faculty require in terms of reading and writing, as well as how much time students spend studying. So you are on the mark that there is variation by field of study, and that is reflected in learning. So we find that fields traditionally associated with liberal arts, social science, humanities, natural science, math, for example, they experience higher learning over the first two and actually even over the whole 4 years of college. So that there is definitely variation in terms of the demands and our studying. But I think one caution there is also whether students are studying to develop specific skills, like engineering, as you mentioned, or whether they are studying to develop more general, broad, critical thinking, analytical reasoning, and writing skills. And I think that higher education is still working on kind of creating the balance of producing individuals, graduates, who have specific skills to take to the labor market, but who also have these general skills that underpin much of what we do.
Mm-hmm. Professor Arum, tell me a little more about this collegiate learning assessment, the standardized test. How many colleges use this, and how old is it? What's its purpose?
Great. Yeah, this is a relatively new indicator developed by the RAND Corporation. In conjunction with some of the top psychometricians in the country from Stanford University and elsewhere. It is an attempt to measure holistically performance tasks that require higher order skills. So what happens is students are given a set of six or seven documents, and they are asked to perform perform a task that requires them to think critically about the different documents that are put in front of them, to synthesize that information, and then to write about them in a specific way. These performance tasks are taken out of experiences, scenarios that a college graduate might be reasonably expected by an employer to perform, to writing a memo to their boss, for example. This test is arguably the state-of-the-art instrument out there. It's going to be used by the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, in their cross-national study, AHELO. It's the first time in 2016 they're going to measure student learning cross-nationally. We're going to see how the U.S. looks relative to other countries. And so it's arguably the state-of-the-art instrument out there. It asks students to do a kind of an authentic task and so on. Now, that's not to say that it's not imperfect, that it doesn't have limitations. All measurement assessments, are by their very nature imperfect and have their limitations. Nevertheless, it is a reasonable approximation of a measure of students' underlying higher order skills to do these sorts of tasks.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Richard in Fort Atkinson next. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Both of my wife and I were doing undergraduate work in the 50s. We both became academics in mathematics and English, respectively. We both were department chairs, and we both are now retired. We have witnessed a great transformation in American higher education, and I think the roots are at their base cultural. The attitude that we experienced as students was a characterization that we were apprentices to experts who were the masters in the disciplines that we studied. Now students see themselves as consumers who pay large amounts of money, very large amounts of money, and as a result, they expect a college degree, whatever their sense or their actual accomplishment. We are well acquainted with and have participated in the higher education system in England. We understand that the great differences between the United States and, say, England and other European countries persist because of this reason. In England, in order to qualify for university, you must pass a battery of what are called ordinary level or O-level exams and then A-level exams for entrance. But the costs are kept within reasonable control so that talented students have the opportunity to perform. The results, in my own experience, because I know English students, are strikingly different than they are here in the United States. Luckily, we have some elite schools, MIT, Caltech, Berkeley, UW-Madison, Ann Arbor, where learning still persists, but I am depressed about the great mass of American institutions across this country.
Professor Aaron.
Yeah, well, so, the call-in, your call-in guest was very, the call-in gentleman was very articulate, I thought, about the state of undergraduate education in the U.S. It would have been very easy before our book to dismiss his concerns as simple old fogyism. Right? You know, this is a guy who's been around for a lot of years. You know, maybe he just has a romantic, sentimental sense of what happened in the past, and it's really not so bad today. So there's been a lot of books out there that have said many of the things that this call-in that the call-in gentleman said. They've been dismissed. Well, you can't dismiss those concerns anymore because we've got the data. We measured it. This is what's going on in higher education, and it's the problem. And so, you know, that's all I can say. Now, the comparisons with England, we don't yet know that. So there we have some interesting anecdotal comments that, you know, may indeed pan out. I'm looking forward to 2016, the HELO study, where we will be measuring, where the OECD will be measuring student performance in higher education, asking kids how many hours they're studying, what are they doing, giving them an objective test cross-nationally, and we'll see how the U.S. higher education system looks. And, I'm very worried that it's like the elementary and secondary system, that the test cross-national studies that have occurred there, PISA and TIMSS and so on, where the U.S. has not come out very, very well. You know, I fear that the higher ed comparisons are not going to look very different.
Thank you, Richard, very much for your thoughtful comments. Cody in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I think it is a matter of priorities at our campus at UWO. We are spending over $100 million at the present moment building buildings, you know, capital improvements. Yeah, we can't pay our teachers, we can't pay our faculty or our staff. And the other thing, point I'd like to make, is that part of the problem, of course it's cultural, but we don't tie the needs of society. Most jobs in this country have to do with wants, things, widgets that we make, and we need to tie our coursework into real-life problems. Instead of building spa-like communities, we need, or spa-like universities, we need students that are working with their community on real problems so that they can develop a passion for their studies. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Professor Roxa.
But thank you for your comment. You know, it has higher education has become kind of a competition to look the best, have the best gym, have the biggest student center, have the nicest lawn and the nicest dorms with all the commodities than what that one might find in a first-class hotel. You know, unfortunately, that ties to the comment that the gentleman made earlier about consumers. If students are consumers and if they are paying for the education supposedly, they're paying to be in college, they're paying for the degree, and they want to have the luxuries of, you know, fancy dorms and gyms and student centers, that's what we seem to be producing. And it is clear that that is misaligned with what higher education should be about, which is about educating the next generation.
Mm-hmm. An email that's come in from Errol, I heard a piece on this topic in the morning news. I'm wondering if you could address the thought that kids are going to college for the degree, not the education. Professor Aaron.
Well, I think there's been, we too often have promoted a logic where students are simply chasing after credentials. And have been told and have too often now come to assume that the credential itself will easily translate into labor market success. And, you know, for the past two decades up till the recent economic crisis, it wasn't a bad assumption that the returns to a college degree were, in historic perspective, very high. However, since this economic crisis, that assumption that you can simply take a credential, and no matter how you got it, no matter how little effort you put into it, to acquiring it, and easily translate that into future lifelong success, has been, you know, is fundamentally been challenged. We're following these kids now into the labor market. The same kids started college in fall 2005. They're now, if they were on time, we surveyed them a year out last spring. We're going to survey them again this spring. And, you know, I can tell you, these kids are struggling. They are struggling. Mm. Large numbers are unemployed. 10% are unemployed.
Oh, yes.
Close to a third of them are back living at home with their families. They have huge debt loads. Large numbers of them have huge debt loads. You know, these kids are struggling. And so, you know, a lot of the assumptions they might have had going in fall 2005, the credential was enough. You know, I'm afraid that logic is one that we did a real disservice to kids promoting.
Mm. Is that, though, partially because the economy is so bad?
Well, you know, that's part of it. But also, you know, where we go from here, it's unclear. If you look at the returns to college over, you know, the past 100 years, what you see is that those returns relative to a high school diploma, they fluctuate. And it is always a worthwhile investment to go to college. Let's make no mistake about it. At the individual level, one should go to college. But the idea that there'll be huge returns to them, to college, and the credential itself is going to give you a job, I think there was something rather anomalous about the 90s and the beginning of the zeros, the odds, I don't know what they're
whatever they are, right.
And we could get into that. I'm not an economist, but it had to do with supply and demand curves, where the growth in four-year college degrees had been flat and the demand for them had increased. It has to do with technological innovation cycles, where when computers were introduced, anyone who knew how to use a computer, someone with a college degree who could use a computer, was in high demand. And then later in that innovation cycle, computers can be used by anyone, including my kids at home today. And so there's lots of good reasons to think that the growing and the historically unprecedented premiums that college degrees we're getting, can no longer be assured going forward. Now, again, that's not to say that, I wouldn't recommend to any young person in this country, not to go to college. Yes, there are returns to college, but they're not going to be as likely to be as simple and easily attained and assumed they might have been in decades past.
Professor Rox, I know you have a class to teach. We thank you very much for your participation in the show and for bringing this issue to our attention. We'll continue on the subject and let you teach your class. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. And Professor Arum will stay with us. We're looking at the book that was just released yesterday, and we have had the co-authors with us. Professor Arum will stay with us now. Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses. We have many, many phone calls and all kinds of emails. We can't possibly get to all of them, but we will get to as many as we can, certainly, during this hour. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today, Peter Bergen joins us, author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Back to phone calls. Steve in Houston, Texas. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yes, I'll try to be quick, and you have a lot of callers. Thank you for this program, by the way. I'm going to read the book. You know, I just read a book that sums up everything you just talked about. It's called The Five-Year Party, and I ran across it. Dr. Craig Brandon from, I think, University of Rhode Island. And it sums up, it says exactly what all of your callers have said, the former retired professors, what your guests have said, that, you know, the tragedy of what they call a dumbing down of education in the public schools, the curriculum, the standards have gotten lower and lower, and you have kids graduating. They can't read and write. I know they come and apply in my business. And they go to college. And Dr. Craig Brandon found that, you know, they're consumers, they're not, and they don't expect, they don't expect to be challenged, and they're not. And they're not prepared. They're not prepared to learn much of anything. They're not prepared to graduate. They shouldn't even be there. And Dr. Brandon made the point that we're doing our kids a big disservice. Some of your guests have said everybody should go to college. In sending kids who aren't qualified, who really don't want to be there, parents are pushing them. We have this gravy train that's pushing so many of our young people into the universities to study what? Political science and sociology, so they can go out and work at McDonald's. And he encourages us to look at the idea of sending our kids to community colleges or to technical schools like they do in Europe, where kids can learn a trade, because we have millions of young people coming into the market with no jobs for them.
All right, Professor Arum.
Well, I haven't read the book that Steve refers to. I will. Certainly, there's many other opportunities out there other than four-year colleges, including the vocational programs that the caller mentions. However, I'd say two things. One, I would totally agree that students are not being adequately challenged when they come into four-year colleges. If you go out and interview freshmen, what they will often tell you is, we thought college was going to be harder than high school, and it's not. It's easier. And they're putting, if you look at the amount of hours they're putting into it as full-time college students, it's considerably less time than even the amount of time they were sitting in seats in high school. And so, we are not challenging them enough. Now, the fact that there are just large numbers of kids that are just unqualified and shouldn't be there, I'd reject that. I'm an optimist in that. I'm a lifelong educator. I taught inner city school in Oakland, California. I believe in the capacity for all individuals to learn. And what's interesting about our approach in measuring student learning in this book is we measure growth. We measure value added. We measure no matter where kids come in from. Some are going to come in, lower than others. Let's be honest. There's no reason that after investing 4 years in college, those kids can't move up. Those kids can't do better. And so, I'm not. I think it's wrong and mistaken just to say, the problem are the kids. They just shouldn't be there. Kids have a responsibility to pursue their education and invest in it. And if they're not doing that, they should take responsibility and be held accountable for sure. But the schools themselves have a responsibility to challenge them and to give them a quality product as well.
Thank you, Steve. Sharon is next. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. Several callers ago, you had a retired professor. He was absolutely right. We use evaluations in the classroom to evaluate the instructor. And if he gets a poor evaluation, if he's not tenured, he's out the door. If he is tenured, he's going to be criticized or his classes won't fill. I used to schedule classes, and we'd have to put our best and most popular professors at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there would be nobody there. And hardly ever, less than 10% of our classes were offered on Friday because the students would go home and they wouldn't take them. It's a cultural thing, and it's involved with students evaluating teachers and job security, parties, laziness. I didn't want to be there. My folks made me come. I'm going to stick it out for a couple of years, and then I'll go do what I want to. There's a lot to this, and the good educations are available in our institutions. But somehow we don't, as youngsters, when we come to college, don't value that learning and don't see the need, because I guess I don't know how we think we're going to have an income when we get done. But it's a whole cultural thing, and I think we have to start with parents and grade school and work right on up.
Professor Arum.
Yeah, well, I would say I agree it's a cultural thing, but let's start with the organizational culture of schools, something we can control, and then the larger, I'm not ambitious enough to take on the culture of the society as a whole but I agree 100% with Sharon and the earlier caller that pointed to course evaluations and the perverse incentives that they've set up. We address that issue in detail in our book, Academically Adrift. And so I just would suggest the audience take a look at the write-up there if they're interested in that question.
Email from Richard in Madison. Have you given thought to decline in teaching quality and the rise of a cadre of professional academic advisors? Professors used to do the job of academic advising. They have refused this kind of contact with students. Academics are treated with ever greater hostility by these academic advisors who describe themselves as equal contributors to student education, learning through advising, etc.
Yeah, well, there's been a dramatic, as there's been declines in full-time faculty in colleges and universities, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of professionals and semi-professional that are working on all these tasks related to student advisement and student services. There's been a dramatic growth of that. I think the caller is wise to point in that direction. I would say, one way to think about it is in recent years, just as undergraduate learning has been pushed to the priority of colleges and universities today, the role of a full-time faculty member has equally been pushed to the periphery of colleges and universities. So if you are going to take seriously that undergraduate learning is central to the core mission of these colleges and universities, you can't do that. You can't fix that problem without putting faculty back in the center and the core of the university as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Sharon, so much for your call. We go to Ryan in Platteville next. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I want to be careful here because I don't want to come across as a cliche, but I'm an English major, and I went into school knowing that my degree wasn't going to guarantee a much higher income. But, I went to learn a craft and learn about language. But I do see a lot of my peers, especially in upper division courses, the intellectual curiosity isn't there. I find professors trying to bring students up to their pace, and sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. But I don't know. I'm glad I went to school. It's my debt. That's all I have. Thank you.
I'll just jump in and say, Ryan, you might have done just what you should have done in college, university. Our book suggests that it's the arts and science course. Including majors such as English, where kids are learning these higher order skills at higher rates. They tend to apply themselves more. And so I wouldn't be surprised over the long term that those higher order skills that you developed are going to pay off for you in terms of your lifelong outcomes, relative to the kid who thought he was getting a jump up, took some quasi-professional program, where there was little academic rigor, grabbed a job that that appeared to be higher paying in the beginning, but was actually flat, had no career ladder trajectory on top of it, and so on. I wouldn't be too discouraged, Ryan.
At least you know he's going to be reading, and that's important.
Yeah. Let me say just a word about that. When we followed up the kids after they graduated, one of the things we asked them a year out of college is how many students, how many of you are graduates, how many of you read the newspaper in print or online? And we found a third of the kids said monthly or never.
Right? Ooh.
These are college graduates. They are, they're out there in these desperate conditions, and they no longer have learned the attitudes and dispositions from their colleges that an adult citizen, in order to kind of, to be a responsible adult citizen and make a contribution to society, that, reading the paper and keeping up with the world is just, it's just a normal part of what
right.
we do.
Right.
And so I think these, the issue, that we're trying to point to in this book, we think actually has broad implications beyond just kind of the economic competitiveness question, but really more fundamentally the one about, how do you have a democratic society where large numbers of kids are going through these schools, and you're expecting them to be the leaders and the core of the democratic society in the future, but you haven't trained them in terms of attitudes, dispositions, and skills in order to make those contributions.
Exactly. They don't have a clue of what's going on. That's awful. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. I really appreciate your time and the study. A great deal of interest in it.
Thank you for inviting us onto your show and drawing attention to this issue.
Our guest, Professor Richard Arum, Professor of Sociology and Education in the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. Also, Professor Josipa Raksa, Assistant Professor of Sociology with an appointment in the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. The book is titled Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses. It was just released yesterday. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for doing our on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting program, and thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them, and we have many, many emails. There's just a profound interest in this topic, so more on it later.